One topic that I've never heard a man discuss is infertility. That'll change today on this edition of Frank Relationships.
You're listening to Frank Relationships with Frank Love.
Frank Love.
Frank Love.
Frank Love.
Frank Love.
Yes, as always, those are my babies. Thanks for getting daddy started today. Mwah. Believe it or not, there's a fifth one of those. I just got to get her in here and add her to the track.
Because when she finds out.
Internationally recognized expert in fertility counseling, Sharon Covington is with us today. And I'm curious. When infertility exists between a heterosexual couple, is it generally the woman that's having the health issue?
That's a really good question, Frank, because I think that people typically believe that infertility is a woman's issue. You know, when you think of historically, with from, you know, kings of England to the Bible, it always ends up identifying a woman as the cause of a fertility-related issue. But in fact, that's false. Approximately a third to 40% of infertility is female-related. Another third to 40%, equal amount, is male-related. Mm-hmm. And about 10% is both, and the other 10% is stuff that we just don't know. So it is shared.
How does the both work?
How does the both work?
Yes, they're just the sperm and the egg are just, they just are giving each other the silent treatment.
It's a good question because a lot of times we don't know why the both don't work. Sometimes it can be because both of them have a problem. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, let's say for an example, there's not enough sperm or it doesn't move fast enough or it's a little funky. Or with a woman, maybe there's trouble with the egg coming down through the fallopian tube or through hormones that she's producing. That's when they both don't work together. But sometimes we just don't know why they don't work.
Mm-hmm. And when
sperm gets a little funky. Don't think somebody's not going to catch that.
There are some funky sperm out there.
Funky sperm,
There's actually different things related to the sperm. It can be the count, the number of them. It can be the shapes of them, the morphology, and it can be the way they move. So there's a number of different factors that can affect the sperm.
And when it is both, is it pretty much a no-go? Is it like, y'all are not going to have a child? Forget it.
No, that's not true at all. In fact, we have some really amazing technologies that are available today to help. Sometimes it can be something very simple, a little medication. Sometimes it can be getting the sperm a little bit closer to the uterus, other things that can be done fairly easily. Mm-hmm. Doesn't even take the high-tech stuff like in vitro fertilization. But absolutely not. When it's both, there's lots of things that can be done and opportunities to help people have babies.
Sharon, how often is it psychological?
Not very much at all.
Okay.
And that's a good question, too, because a lot of people think that it can be related to stress.
Right.
And because infertility is an inherently stressful experience. But we know that people get pregnant under the most stressful of experiences, mm-hmm. when they really don't want to. And so it's really important that people get the help that they need without thinking that it's something that they're doing that's causing the infertility.
What are some of the causes of infertility?
Good question, too. Today, age is probably one of the bigger causes of it because people are waiting to have kids. It can be also related to both a woman or a man's weight. It can be related to the effects of sexually transmitted diseases, which cause scarring. Mm. It can be related to environmental factors, the toxins that are out there in the area, or even things like cigarettes or even drugs and alcohol can be a factor too. But today, age tends to be the biggest factor because people are waiting later to have babies.
And what's the no-no age where you're saying, look, if you genuinely want a child, don't mess around and wait until this age.
50.
Yeah. Oh, no, 50 is... way before then. 50 would be
well, I'm just thinking
not
we were
at
just
all
talking
age.
About Janet Jackson.
I would say you want to wait 35. There's a marked difference between 35 and 40. It begins to drop off. In fact, we tell couples that if you have been trying to, if you've been trying to have a baby, if you're under the age of 35, you can wait a year and come in for an evaluation. But if you're over the age of 35 or 40, you don't want to wait longer than 6 months. Over 40, it drops dramatically.
Well, what about race and even location? Is race an issue, and is whether you live in Washington, D.C. or L.A., is there a difference there?
You know, I don't know anything about geography per se. Race, definitely, there are disparities there, and African-American women are approximately 1.5 to 2 times higher than white women, and I think males it's approximately about the same. And one of the reasons for this is that African American women tend to wait longer in going for treatment, and there's a number of factors for that.
I assume you could point a finger at health disparities and.
Health disparities, and sometimes people are also, you know, worried about the technology itself, mm-hmm. and fearing that they can't afford it. I guess that's related to health disparities too. Yeah,
is it religious too?
I think for African American couples, it can be that there can be a feeling that that this is what God has. Given them, and that if God wanted you to have children, then you'd have them, and that really, you know, again, that really just isn't a factor. While religion can play a strong role in spirituality and giving us strength to go through these, I don't think it's something that people are being punished with. So sometimes people do wait because of the belief that if it was meant to happen, then it would.
Sharon, we've got a wise guy here in the radio station. He generally will weigh in, but I'm going. Do you know this gentleman, Jeff, the man behind the boards? He just passed me a note and said,
"Oh, good.
Might it have something to do with grape soda, or Kool-Aid?"
Hey, don't editorialize.
If you put a little alcohol in it, yes. I think that we do have questions about the effect of toxins and the food that we eat and how that can affect fertility. But I don't think the research is as high for that. Definitely, if you add some alcohol into that, alcohol can be a factor.
Mm.
Or if you're smoking something while you're drinking your Kool-Aid.
Sharon, all jokes aside, can diet, vitamins, certain foods affect the potency of sperm or
the vitality?
Because I heard, like, eat a lot of broccoli and your partner will have if you're a male, and you'll have a boy.
Yeah, no, I've never seen
lifestyle.
Any research on that. You know, and again, I'm not a dietitian, but I've never seen anything that that the kinds of food that you eat can affect the whether you have male or female children. Certainly it's good. You know, if you take good care of your body, you're in a better place to go through treatment. But I think there's little evidence to show that the foods that we eat have a strong influence, with the exception of one thing, though, as I say, that's soy. Now, this is for women, but if women eat a lot of soy, it can increase the estrogen in your body. So that's one of the things that people tell you to stay away from.
Why not men? I mean, I know several vegetarian men who make a point of not eating soy because it contains estrogen.
I've heard it less often said with men, but it certainly makes sense that it would because, again, the soy... creates estrogen, and that can affect the hormones within a male body. So it makes sense to me. I hear it with women frequently. I haven't heard it so much with men. But it makes sense.
Instead of man boobs.
Okay.
And what about shellfish, oysters, and
Never
heard anything about that.
In terms of potency?
Never heard anything about that. I know. I've heard wives' tales about it, but I've never seen any research about it.
I love it.
But don't they contain zinc, and zinc is good for the male's prostate?
You know, you're getting out of my field because I don't know that much about the nutrition piece of it, and I've never heard that. I've never heard that in either the research or discussions that I've seen.
Okay. All right.
That's a bit out of my area.
Understood. Okay. Welcome to Frank Relationships, a show for you, my brethren, who, like me, are too young to be considered old and too old to be considered young. It's also for those of you who love and support us. We're here to provide weekly wisdom, conversation, and the information that'll help create loving and flexible parents and partners. I'm Frank Love, and you can find me, my blog, and my various social media incarnations at franklove.com. If you're listening to the show on Blog Talk Radio, please follow us, and if via iTunes, please subscribe so that you can effortlessly get the show each week. Also, if you're enjoying the show, and of course you are, please give us a favorable iTunes rating, and please share it with your family and friends on your favorite social media platform. We're always looking for new social media friends, so please help us help our communities by spreading the word about the show. Greetings to my super-duper co-host, Nancy Goldring.
Good morning, Frank.
The consummate generalist is in the house.
By all means.
Today's guest is a clinical social worker and internationally recognized expert in fertility counseling. With over 40 years of experience in reproductive health, she has. Her passion is working with individuals, couples, and groups around reproductive loss. And she's been recognized as one of Washingtonian Magazine's top therapists for her work in this area. She's also the director of psychological support services for Shady Grove Fertility, the United States' largest assisted reproductive technology program, and an assistant clinical professor at Georgetown University School of Medicine and the Department of Obstetrics.
Yes.
And gynecology.
Get up on your women's information, dude.
Thank you. Thank you.
They're tongue twisters.
Tongue twisters, right. yes, about women's health, exactly.
So, if you, like me, want to know why Nancy talks so much,
$10,000 is the one with the answer.
Excuse me, Sharon. I didn't mean to step on your toes there. If you, like me, want to know how common infertility is, the impact infertility has on psychological well-being, and the differences in how men and women deal with infertility, then stay tuned as your Frank Relationship team talks with the co-editor of the classic, Infertility Counseling, a comprehensive handbook for clinicians, Ms. Sharon Covington. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Frank. And Nancy, it's great to be here.
Wonderful to have you.
Before we get too deep in today's subject matter, I want to check and see what's going on in the news. Ms. Covington, please don't be bashful. We certainly want your thoughts, too. All right, let's see what we got. Psychology Today. Saw an article yesterday on Thanksgiving and how to win over your romantic partner's family. All right, Nancy, you got any tips that you want to just throw out there? Or even you, Sharon?
How to win? To me, I would think, it seems cliche to say, but be yourself, which could be dangerous.
Yeah.
I was going to say behave yourself.
Behave yourself.
There's a difference.
Yeah. And be interested in the person's family. Like, really, don't just endure the experience, mm-hmm, or hope the food is good. Be interested genuinely, mm-hmm, in the people you encounter, in her family members.
Engage them in conversations. Don't sit back waiting for them to engage you. Mm-hmm. I think also good manners go a long way. Do something that shows that you're happy to be there, and let them know after you've been there that you appreciate the invitation. Those kinds of things mean a great deal.
You sound like a pro, Sharon.
Yeah, good behavior. I believe in good behavior.
All right. Now, okay, so do you have children that are old enough to have come home and brought that special someone with them?
Well, actually, I have three kids. Two are married, but my youngest daughter is not, and she is bringing someone home this year. It's been a while. So we are experiencing this, and interestingly, he's from Australia, mm-hmm. so he's never experienced a Thanksgiving, nor experienced a Thanksgiving with our family because we have a very large family gathering. I'm having 40 for dinner.
Wow.
So it can be overwhelming, mm-hmm. and I think you learn a lot about someone when they come into an experience like that.
You absolutely do. Yeah. Well, please, I'm going to ask that you not take these tips that I'm about to share and hold them against him if he doesn't do it.
Okay, I will.
All right, first is don't come empty-handed. And you've already really touched on that when you said be involved. Call ahead, find out what to bring. A small toy for the kids or flowers. It paves the way for a smooth and generous entry. So when you walk in the door with something in your hand, you get received a little different than if you walk in like Nancy does when she comes by.
Oh, my goodness. I'll correct that, Frank.
Okay. Be well rested. Showing up to a holiday gathering sleep deprived or exhausted is a big mistake. Mm-hmm. Think of family gatherings as preparing for a marathon, and you want to be in shape.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Three, lay off the booze. I can see how that's, yeah.
Absolutely. Could be problematic, yes. Uh-huh. Yes.
Have an escape plan. Before you arrive, make a plan with your partner. Have a strategy that includes emergency exits, secret calls for help, timeouts.
Are you serious? Oh,
yeah,
my goodness.
Check in with each other throughout the visit. Stay united and be supportive.
Okay. That, you know, that's one I suggest to couples all the time when they go to family gatherings, particularly when they're going through infertility and it can be quite painful. Always have an escape plan and always have a signal that allows that escape plan. You know, like when I pull my ear, it means it's time we need to go.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, given what you just said, I'm reminded, I was watching House of Cards last night, and like the last episode in the current season, or the second to the last, something like that. And the first lady, Robin Wright,
I'm not a House of Cards fan.
Have you watched
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it's awesome.
Okay.
Yeah.
Have you seen it, Sharon?
A long time ago,
okay.
But I know who Robin Wright is.
Okay, so mm-hmm. the candidate that is the... He's the Democrat. So the Republican candidate, the Republican nominee, he and his wife and children were by the White House. And they were talking with the president. And the wife said to Robin Wright, she said, do you ever regret not having children? Hmm. And the Robin Wright said, do you ever regret having them?
Wow. Wow. Brilliant question.
That was the end
Brilliant
of the conversation.
That is a really good question.
Brilliant question.
Yeah. So given that and what I've just lobbed into the circle, are there some questions that you suggest that people just don't ask?
Well, I think one is, when are you going to have kids?
Mm-hmm.
Because if people are having trouble having kids, it's an extraordinarily difficult question to answer. If people aren't interested in having kids, I think they feel that it's intrusive also. Mm-hmm. So I think that's kind of fundamental. The other thing is, if you are with someone, looks like maybe she's put on a little weight, mm-hmm. to say, are you pregnant?
Ooh.
Don't ever
Ooh.
Assume someone's pregnant.
Right, right.
Yeah, unless they're really bulging, like
right,
they look
right.
like they...
Or they've announced it.
Yes, yes. Okay.
But isn't that sort of a new phenomenon to stay away from, when are you guys going to have kids? That question is so old in the...
But it may have been offensive, even though it's old.
You mean
people,
even years ago?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I think that question's been asked forever.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I think that, first of all, there's an assumption, particularly, you know, years ago, that people were going to have kids and they'd have kids right away. That changed once we had birth control, or women's birth control, mm-hmm. And, you know, with the pill. And then people started delaying having children. And so the question came from somewhat different angle, rather than it's just assumed, you know, you had more control over when you were choosing to have a child.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay, let me finish out my little list here. We said have escape plan. Help out. You get more points when you're doing dishes or clearing the table. Take a break. Slip away for some fresh air. Avoid hot topics. Leave politics and religion alone. Think time limited. For goodness sake, don't stay too long. If you do, plan lots of activities and keep busy. Don't play therapist. The holidays are not a time to resolve ancient family conflicts. And skip the advice. Solicited or unsolicited advice will always backfire. In general, listen more than you talk. People love good listeners and will feel relaxed in your presence. Okay. All right. So
I think those are great.
I think they're pretty on the spot.
Not just for Thanksgiving, anytime.
Yeah.
That's true. Okay.
Nice.
Let's see.
So, Frank.
Huh?
Before you go any further.
Hit it.
Where have you been?
What you got? Let's see. I was in San Diego.
Really?
Yes. San Diego State University.
Okay.
Just a few somethings ago.
And where are you going?
I am headed to a place I cannot pronounce. Coeur d'Alene.
Coeur
d'Alene? It's not Washington. Yes, it's Idaho.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Idaho.
So, do you know how to say that, Sharon?
I do not. Never heard of it. What are you doing there, Frank?
I've got a presentation I'm going to be doing.
Okay.
So I've got, I'll be running my mouth. That's what
going.
I'm doing. Yeah. So
it sounds like you're the guy to be booked.
That's what I enjoy doing.
That's what the police say.
Yeah.
So what if someone wanted you to come and speak to their organization?
Shoot me an email.
Really?
Yes.
Is it that easy?
It's that easy. Mm. We'll figure it out.
Okay.
Okay. All right, Miss Covington.
You can endure this guy at your function. Go on, Frank.
Let's get to the good stuff. Back to the interview. What is the impact of infertility on the psychological well-being of men and women?
It's really profound. I think most of us spend most of our life trying not to get pregnant. And so when people are ready to have a child, they assume it's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly like in this area, in the Washington area, people are very hard-driving, working towards goals, and they just assume that it's going to be able to happen when they're ready to. So when it doesn't, I think it can be a profound emotional experience and cause feelings that most people never imagined that they would have.
Mm-hmm.
It creates a experience of grief because you're grieving over something that you long for and that you wish that you could have. And yet it is something that is invisible to everybody else. So it's a disconnect in that way. It becomes something that becomes very, very hard to grieve. And then it's also difficult because men and women will experience it differently. For a woman, the being able to be pregnant and give birth is part of who we are, part of why we were created, and not to be able to do that really affects how you see yourself as a woman. But the same thing can happen for a man if it ends up to be male factor. As I said, most people don't even assume that it's male factor. They just assume that it's women. So, and then men deal with their feelings in a different way than women do. And so that kind of disconnect in a relationship can be difficult. But even if you're in a homosexual couple, lesbian couples or gay male couples, some of these same things can still be experienced, even though technically they may not be infertile. In other words, they need help to become pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
But they may not have infertility. Sometimes they do, too. Sometimes there can still be a male factor or a female factor that's involved. But some of those same things can still occur just because, people are different in a relationship, so they can experience these things in a very different way.
Mm. Are there certain stages of the process? So do people start to try to get pregnant and then... how long do they typically say, how long does it take for them to typically say, this isn't working, and start to worry? And then when they start to worry, do they start drinking tea? And then when they stop drinking tea, do they go to the doctor, and then when they go to the general practitioner, do they go to
It's a process, is what you're saying. Yeah. You know, it can be very different for different people. I know people, young couples, you know, in their late 20s, early 30s, they don't get pregnant the first month and they start to worry about it.
Right.
Where it takes, the average is about 6 months it takes to get pregnant. Then I know other people who've literally waited 10 years before seeking treatment, and they might get anxious and they might try to do different things. So a lot of it depends on your personality. Mm-hmm. You know, if you are a real hard-driving, controlling person, you're going to start to try to drink the tea and control the environment and, you know, reading all that you can. If you are more laid back, or even, you know, maybe of a more spiritual basis, mm-hmm. you may just kind of wait to see how long it goes on. When people do seek help, they usually go to their OBGYN and get an initial workup. Mm-hmm. What sometimes happens, though, with an OBGYN is that they're just looking at the woman. And as I told you, it's equally divided between men and women with the causal factor. So it's very important if someone goes to their OBGYN that the male partner gets tested, too. Mm-hmm. And then if it's not working, and there's things that OBGYNs can do as far as medication, as far as inseminations and that they can do. But if a couple is older, and that's usually after the age of 35, then they really need to see a specialist, a reproductive endocrinologist, to be assessed.
I wonder if the following situation has ever showed up at your office. The woman is on the pill. She doesn't want children, but she's unwilling to tell her husband, and he has asked her to come in to see about, and so she's not getting pregnant, but she's hiding that the reason she's not getting pregnant because she's on the pill. Yes.
Oh,
and the husband somehow gets her to come into the office, and she tells you what's going on, but she can't tell him. What has that ever happened?
I have not seen that, but
okay.
I would not be surprised at all if it's happened.
Mm-hmm.
It's lots of times the other way around.
Okay.
That husband doesn't want to have kids and she does. And so he is saying he doesn't. So she goes off the pill and then becomes pregnant and he feels really duped by it. It's a little bit easier, I suppose, for her to hide with, you know, with her taking the pill. But normally by the time they get to us in a specialized clinic, that hasn't occurred.
Mm-hmm. The stakes are too
high, still kind of deceiving mm-hmm. him in some way. And again, they're not dealing with an infertility problem, then they're dealing with a marital problem.
Absolutely. Tell me about your clinic.
Our clinic is the largest reproductive medical practice in the country. And it's kind of interesting because I started 25 years ago with three other doctors, and myself and a couple of urologists. And our practice has grown dramatically. We're up to, I think, 36 doctors. I have a staff of 9 psychologists and social workers who serve our office, lots
wow.
of people. But what we really have tried to focus on from the very beginning is to treat the whole patient. It's mm-hmm. not just infertility is not just a medical condition. It's as much an emotional condition, a psychological experience. And we feel that it's really important that we treat all aspects of what a couple or an individual experiences as they go through this. So we're very proud of the work we do.
I bet. And how do you get rewarded from parents, for people that are now parents and can directly say that it is related to what you guys do or have done? What do they do?
I tell you, it's one of the best parts of my work
mm-hmm.
is when I've worked with a couple who has really struggled to have a baby and eventually gets pregnant and then has that baby. I always have people come back for a visit where we can sit down with their baby so we can kind of talk about the fruits of our labor.
Mm-hmm.
I also work a lot with couples who've lost a baby in pregnancy, you know, through a miscarriage or a stillbirth,
mm-hmm.
and are dealing with that trauma and then may struggle to get pregnant again. And then being pregnant again, they're so anxious and it's so stressful. and to you know, get to the other side of that. It's just the best part. I feel like I am so blessed to be able to share in this experience of this struggle, mm-hmm. and to be able to see people build the families that they long for and they love. I mean, look at Frank. You've got five kids.
Yeah.
You know, you know the joy that it gives you, and that's what people are wanting to share in that experience, and to be able to feel like you've helped them get there is just a real privilege.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can imagine the rewarding feeling that you experience when it all comes together. You mentioned STDs and the effects of having had STDs can mm-hmm. have a something to do with
scarring. You mentioned
infertility.
Yeah. STDs are a big risk factor in infertility, and in fact, it's one of the leading causes of infertility with African Americans. Yeah, uterine fibroids are weight is an issue for African Americans, and then STDs. And it's because the disease can cause scarring and infection in the uterus, mm-hmm. and in the fallopian tubes, and so that the egg can't pass through the tube in order to get to the uterus. And then it also can affect the ability, scarring within the uterus, too, as far as implantation goes. Mm-hmm. So it's a big factor and really needs to be treated very quickly if anyone is experiencing either, you know, gonorrhea, chlamydia, anything like that.
So are all of them possibly let's say gonorrhea, chlamydia, syphilis, might all three of those, and that's certainly not all of them, lead to scarring, or is it one more than the other?
No, I think they all they all can lead to different kinds of scarring. So
is
they
one
really
worse
need to
than
be
any
treated
of the rest?
And again, it's higher in the African American community, and so people really need to be vigilant and aware.
Mm-hmm. No, I think the question is one STD kind of like the big villain of the bunch?
I can't answer that. I know gotcha. Gonorrhea is one that they particularly talk about in relationship to scarring, but I think all of them can
sure.
can cause chlamydia and syphilis.
Mm-hmm.
You
wow.
hear less about syphilis these days. But.
Mm-hmm. Well, what are the differences between men and women and how they deal with infertility?
Women tend to emote more and need to want to, you know, talk more about it and be socially, you know, connecting to others. You know, women really use relationships as kind of the fabric of the way they work things through. Men tend to, you know, kind of keep things inside, and I think particularly with male factor infertility, that's not something that men will talk about. Well, where women will, you know, it's not something they share with their guy friends.
Mm-hmm.
And men, you know, tend to want to kind of look to the answer, you know, figure out how to fix it. Whereas women may just need not so much to be looking towards the answer, but really need to be able to talk and to process what is going on.
How does the psychological landscape change for a man when it looks like the answer is a donor?
It's really tough. It's you know, for some men, they look upon it as an easy answer. They
okay.
think this will solve the problem. I see my partner is in pain, if we're talking about a sperm donor.
Yes.
And this will fix the problem, and they don't often get the opportunity to really deal with their emotions about it, which is really important. In other words, it's a grieving process. They have to come to terms with the fact they will not have a biological connection to a child. And then for others, it can be a huge issue because of feeling that of that loss and a fear that they may not be able to attach to a child that is not genetically connected to them. So, you know, people are very different. It depends a lot on their families or life experiences and how they adjust to this. But, you know, I think what's difficult for men is they just don't have the kinds of places that they can talk about this and process it in the way that women do. There's a lot of jokes that go around about guys, you know, about, you know, shooting blanks and, you know, if their wife isn't pregnant, well, you know, I'll help you out there, or, you know, kind of stuff that can be extraordinarily hurtful to a guy if he's dealing with this.
That's deep.
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah. What about?
I've heard awful things that have been said to guys about this.
Mm-hmm. What about the divorce rate? I mean, is there a divorce component?
You know, I can't quote you any research on this because there's differing research on it. I think a lot depends on the strength of a relationship. One of the things that we do know is that, in fact, this can make a relationship stronger, that people can learn coping mechanisms about dealing with adversity and struggles and communication that can carry them throughout their marriage. Because what I say to couples is, this isn't the only awful, terrible thing you're ever going to go through. So you can learn things from this if you use the opportunity. If couples go into this experience of infertility, though, when they're already having problems, you know, they see things in different ways, they are feeling really alienated from each other, they may be unhappy with the relationship and they're just going along with the with their partner, you know, about having a baby, and then they start to experience these things, it can cause significant issues. But the research shows that the divorce rate isn't necessarily higher as a result of this.
Mm-hmm. And we discuss race, we discuss geography. What about nationality? Is there anything there?
Nationality as far as infertility rates or
yes.
the way people deal with it or what?
Any of
what
that.
Do you,
so
what do you think?
Is it different between the United States and India? Yeah.
Oh, sure. Well, culturally, certainly the way people deal with infertility can be very different. And one of the things we're seeing at our clinic, because it is so loud, we see many, many people come in from Europe, from Asia, from all over for treatment, because the United States offers treatment that other companies, in fact, may be banned in other countries.
Like what?
You know, we take pretty much a laissez-faire approach to this kinds of things in the United States, whereas, let's say, in Europe, donor anonymity is banned. We have anonymous donors here. It isn't allowed in England and Australia. You can't be anonymous if you donate. You have to be willing to be identified. Mm-hmm. Or in some countries where you can't get treatment at all, if you're, let's say, a gay couple, you can't get treatment using a surrogate or an egg donor, so you may go to India or something like that. As far as culturally how people deal with it, you know, if you're from a culture that is very, paternalistic, or you very strong cultural values in it, for example, like India, if you don't have a child, you could be ostracized. And it's one of the reasons we see in those cultures the cases of people, very old people having babies and they're using a donor egg. They have women in their 70s that are having babies in India because they never had kids. Now they can use donor eggs. Very scary. Very scary.
Wow.
If you want to see some really scary things, go to YouTube and put up older moms having babies, and they have, you know, have stories and pictures. I think the oldest one was like 73 or 75 or something like that. Because what happens is that they have these strong, they want these children so they can be a part of the culture and they can be accepted.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, they're 75 years old. They're not going to be able to live to raise these kids.
Right.
Very, very concerning. And then you have, you know, cultures with, you know, like the United States or in Europe, where independence is more valued. So the issues around not having kids is different than in cultures that really strongly value children as part of the community.
And how might the same? Okay, so we're discussing nationality, as in India, America, you know, United States. What about Indians, meaning those from India and the United States?
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the cultural issues that arise for them, for Chinese, for Nigerians? You know, what do you see there?
Well, you know, again, even though they are living in this country, they bring the culture of their origins to the experience. Mm-hmm. You know, in the African cultures, we see a lot of African patients that are coming through. And again, the, you know, having a child is part of your identity and how you see yourself and who you are. And you know, it's interesting because those kinds of cultures often have less concerns about using a donor, because in the culture, you families help each other, or communities help each other. So it doesn't kind of matter whose child is who. You know, it's genetic kinship, family kinship, so that you're connected by the community, but not necessarily by genetics. Mm-hmm. So those people, you know, often have less difficulty with it. Then, you know, in some of the Asian cultures, you certainly really don't, the Asian, South Asian, you don't talk about those kinds of experiences. And so it's kept very private and very secretive. And there can be also a lot of pressure. Again, the assumption that the infertility is caused by the woman within the culture, mm-hmm. which is not true. Mm-hmm. And there can be real pressures on these women to have children when it really isn't their fault. And I've known of a number of situations where families were living together here in the United States, and the daughter-in-laws were taking terrible abuse from the mother-in-laws with the assumption that it was her that wasn't able to get pregnant, when in fact it was male factor.
Wow. You mentioned earlier that weight was in the top three.
Yeah.
Concerns for at least African-American women.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And
it's becoming more so with everyone, but yes, with African-Americans, it's true.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And I know at least in some cultures, African cultures,
mm-hmm.
Woman's weight is like...
beautiful.
Yeah.
Right, right.
So how do you counsel a woman who's of a particular size... I mean, is it just as basic as telling her to go and drop a couple of pounds? How is the weight actually impacting her capacity to become pregnant or not?
Well, what happens is that the weight increases hormones within the body, which can affect the ability to get pregnant. And you say, is it as easy as just telling her to go drop a few pounds? Let me tell you, there is nothing harder than you can tell these women to go drop a few pounds.
Sure.
Obesity is becoming epidemic in this country, as we know. But our problem is that when we have women come in who we say if they can lose as little as 10% of their body weight, it can affect their fertility. So if you're talking about a woman who is, let's say, 300 pounds, if she can lose 30 pounds, that can affect positively her fertility. That is not an easy thing to tell someone to do. And we don't have good resources to help people. We now at Shady Grove are developing a wellness program. We're going to have nutritionists on board and other specialists to help women with the process of losing weight, because it isn't just a nutritional thing. It's also an emotional thing that can affect them.
What about the cost?
The cost for what?
For treatment? Yeah. It's pretty intense, isn't it?
Do you mean for in regards to weight or for
infertility treatment?
Well, it can, you know, IVF can cost $10,000 to $15,000. You add donor issues in there, the cost can go up dramatically. On the good note is that many insurances do cover infertility treatment. And for example, in Maryland, infertility treatment using IVF, in vitro fertilization, which is kind of the high-tech part of infertility treatment, it's mandated for 3 treatment cycles. The other thing is that programs such as ours, Shady Grove, has at what's called a shared risk program, so that people can not only get financing to do it, but also get be able to put in a certain amount of money and are guaranteed either a take-home baby at the end of all of this, or they get their money back. And so those programs have become quite popular. Now, it does mean you have to put up a big chunk of change. I think it's maybe $25,000 or $30,000.
Wow.
And then you do have to pay your medications. But it does, it's been a very successful and positive program, we feel, because we want to give people the message that we really want to help you have a baby, and if we can't help you this way, then you will have money at the end of it if you choose to adopt or do something else.
Okay, a woman is working at Walmart,
mm-hmm.
and she cannot seem to conceive.
Right.
If she's listening to the show and hears the number, you know, 15, 20,000, something like that, she's not going to call you guys, or she's
right.
You know, what do you suggest she do?
Well, she might have some insurance companies through Walmart. She might not have coverage for this,
mm-hmm.
but at the very first she ought to go to her gynecologist, her OBGYN.
And when I say she's working at Walmart, her name is not, her last name isn't, what is it, Walton?
Well, she should have some insurance coverage. You know, today with our Affordable Care Act, people have access to that in a way they haven't before.
Mm-hmm.
That she should start with a basic workup with her gynecologist to find out, you know, what the cause might be.
Mm-hmm.
There are even at our program, we do have not sliding scales isn't the word I'm trying to think of. We do have scholarships for that we will offer. There's also a wonderful program called the CADE Foundation. It's based here in Baltimore very active, and they provide scholarships to people who can't afford treatment. You have to apply for it, and so there are resources out there that can help people. But sometimes even there's clinics that just either free clinics, even Planned Parenthood will do some initial workups, I believe, too.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Frank Relationships, and we're talking with Sharon Covington, the co-editor of the Classic Infertility Counseling, a comprehensive handbook for clinicians. Ms. Covington, please tell us what you're up to and how we can find you.
Well, I am director of psychological support services for Shady Grove Fertility. I can be found there if you go to the shadygrovefertility.com website. You can also go to my website, covingtontherapy.com. I have a practice in Montgomery County, Maryland, in Bethesda, and in Rockville. And I am very involved in training and educating mental health professionals to be able to work with people with reproductive health issues, because this is a fairly new and evolving area. And I am still doing some writing and teaching, but I think the thing I love most is I love working with individuals and couples around these issues.
Mm-hmm. Very nice. What can men do to support their partners during infertility or after, let's say, a pregnancy loss?
Yeah, I get this question often. And sometimes I get calls from a woman saying, I'm really struggling, I'm having a hard time, want to come in to talk. And I say, well, what about your husband? She said, well, no, he's not having a hard time. I'm having a hard time. I want to come in. And I always encourage people to come as a couple, because I find that, men frequently get kind of pushed out of this and kind of pushed to the side. And then what I hear when I come in is that, you know, guys see their partner struggling and they see her hurting and they just don't feel equipped to know how to help. And so the first thing we do is we try to work a little bit on the communication. The idea is sometimes just listening and just giving a hug can be the best thing you can ever give your partner.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes that can be hard for guys, because when they hear her upset, they want to do something. They want to make it better. They want to fix it. I talk about, you know, boys in their toys or guys in their toolboxes. You know, they want to get it out and they want to fix it really quick. And these things don't fix so easily. And the ability to be able to hear what she's saying, what she's feeling, being able to reflect back, being able to give a hug, being able to listen is really important.
And what about when the tables are turned? What can a woman do to support her partner?
Well, I think women need to kind of look at what it is that their husband needs in order to de-stress and feel better, and to be able to recognize that he isn't going to deal with it in the same way that she does.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe he does need more time in his man cave. Maybe he needs more time to go out and hit some golf balls, do something physical. Guys often, you know, kind of need something physical to kind of get rid of some of the energy. I think also, too, the thing that sometimes gets lost is a sexual relationship. You know, for guys, it can be a real stress reducer. For women, it can feel like another thing that she has to do. And so being able to separate the whole baby making from the love making, to be able to kind of put some of the romance back in the relationship, for men particularly, can be very helpful and very useful.
Is it insensitive to be romantic during a situation where infertility is kind of in the atmosphere, they're trying and it's not happening, and maybe it is the woman? Is it insensitive of the man to be romantic, to be sexual, but not necessarily concerned about her getting pregnant?
You know what? It's not insensitive. It's essential.
Okay.
The couples need to really be able to be reminded of how important that experience is in showing caring. And sometimes it doesn't have to be, you know, sex. Sometimes it can be, you know, just hugging and kissing and being close. The other thing that is important for couples to talk about, whereas, you know, there's a saying that women need to feel loved in order to have sex. Men need to have sex in order to feel loved.
Right.
So they come at it from different angles from this. And that's, you know, this isn't across the board. People are different, of course. But you need to kind of keep that in mind. So for a man, he may really need to give her some emotional time and space to be close in order to have the intimacy. For a woman, she may need to really think about trying to be intimate in order to then get that emotional space.
Back to kind of a conversation about culture, I find it interesting and just kind of worth kicking around.
Sure.
What are some of the myths around
different cultures?
Yeah, African Americans,
infertility,
whites, you know, Hindu. You know, what are some of the myths that go with the cultural whatever?
Well, we talked about some of the myths with, you know, African American, for example, that black men and women don't have fertility issues. We know that they do.
Mm-hmm.
As far as some of the other cultures, you know, I don't think so much of myths as some of the realities.
Okay. Sure. Is there a statistical...
For example, in some of the Asian cultures that are really quite sexually repressed, we will have people present for treatment that have never actually had sex, and they're coming for infertility treatment because they can't understand why they're not getting pregnant.
But they've never had sex?
They've never had sex. They don't know how to have sex. Or there can sometimes have been sexual trauma in their history or their culture, and so they don't want to have sex.
Good night. I mean, that's a whole nother show.
Wow.
Yep. We talk about sexual dysfunction masquerading as infertility. In other words, they come in for infertility treatment, and it isn't infertility. It's because they don't know how to have sex, they haven't learned how to have sex, or they're afraid to have sex.
Okay, what do you say?
Right. Yeah.
Should be a pretty easy appointment.
Well, you know, there's a couple of ways the doctors will go after this. First of all, if that's the case, they may well refer them to us for counseling to try to understand it. It depending on their age, it may be something that they don't want to wait for them to try to work out the sexual issue or the sexual dysfunction, because sometimes it can take a long time. It can be quite significant. It isn't a matter of you just educating them. It can be a lot of other things that are related. And so they may actually decide to do treatment on them, you know, like IVF. But at the same time, they would recommend that they get either marital help or sexual sex therapy for doing it. It can be very complicated.
Yeah, I can imagine. Are we talking about 20-year-olds, 40-year-olds?
Oh, no. Usually they're in their 30s.
Still young people.
Sometimes 40s.
No.
Depending on when they've gotten married. Usually not 20-year-olds.
To be in their 30s with that kind
30s.
Of...
30s?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That's
I know, it's surprising to hear, isn't it? But there are certain cultures. You see it particularly in the South Asian cultures, you know, in India, China.
It's China? The most
Japan,
populated
you know, some
country?
Some of the Asian, Southeast Asian cultures.
Mm. India?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they are able to procreate, seems like.
No, she's saying, but you see this phenomenon.
This is not a generalization to all people within the culture.
Yeah,
that's true. This is not a rare occurrence that we may see because of, you know, and again, in those cultures, there's arranged marriages. Even in the United States, they come here and they will still, you know, they'll still be arranged marriages. They may go back to India or Pakistan or whatever to come married and get married, and then they come back here. So you have those kinds of issues too, people that don't know each other, let alone haven't really been educated about sex.
Any suggestions on keeping your romance alive during infertility?
Yeah, that's a really, really important thing. You know, I think that I talk a lot to them about, you know, really working on their relationship, working as a team. I talk about taking breaks from some vacation from treatment. If they're in the middle, you know, they have an unsuccessful cycle, maybe they want to wait a month or two before starting up again because the treatment itself can be very difficult. I think what I mentioned before about separating baby making from love making, you know, this can take a terrible toll on your sexual relationship when it becomes all about making a baby. It takes kind of the play out of it. So to be able to separate that out. So sometimes having different bedrooms, you know, you have one bedroom that you use to make babies in, the other one you use to play in, you have fun in.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard that recommended before.
Wow, I never thought about that.
And you know, the other thing I talk to them about is that if you do get pregnant, once you get pregnant, then people usually get afraid to have sex while they're pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
There's not necessarily a reason for that, and it's a good thing to talk to your doctor. But after all of that, then they're afraid they might jiggle something and something might happen. So then they have their baby, and they're too tired to have sex.
Mm-hmm.
And so then they're coming back to me, you know, 3 or 4 years later because they're not having any sort of intimacy. And the havoc from the infertility has been carried through, you know, afterwards, and they really need some help with that. So they need to be aware of that, and they need to work on that. Another thing that I think is really important is to really be conscious about communicating the positives. You know, when we're struggling with something, it is so easy for us to tell our partner what's going wrong with them, and then we just kind of take the positives for granted.
Mm-hmm.
But we catch more flies with honey than we do with salt. Mm-hmm. So it's really communicating the positives to our partner when things are feeling good is just very, very important.
I mean, that's very important, period.
So well, it is. A lot of these things are important.
Speaking
you know,
of the positives, I'm not totally 100% sure on the numbers, but recently I was told that Shady Grove, I don't know how many years you guys have been around right
25.
Now. 25. And what do you have, 40,000 kids are on the planet because of your work?
That could be. I'm actually not positive, but we're just celebrating our 25th anniversary. I think it is about 40,000. I think there's babies that are born. I got to get better on these statistics. They won't be happy to hear that I don't know them offhand. I think babies are born every, like, 3 or 4 babies every hour or few minutes in this area.
Really?
We now extend from Pennsylvania, Maryland, D.C., and Virginia. Yeah.
Mm.
Very proud of our work.
Yeah, I bet. Any message for the LGBTQ community?
Yeah, you know, there's been tremendous changes. When I started out in this work, we definitely weren't treating gay couples, and we very limitedly lesbian couples, and now we treat everyone, and that's wonderful because we have great resources and assistance, and people who long and wish to have a family now can have a family. As I said, many of these couples don't actually have a fertility problem, and so coming to an infertility clinic is sometimes a little off-putting. But we work very hard to service the needs of these couples who are seeking to have families, and with donor sperm, with donor egg, and then of course with gay couples, the need for a gestational carrier. These are things that we all work with and assist them in helping to build the families that they long for and they wish for.
You're listening to Frank Relationships, and we've been talking with Sharon Covington, the co-editor of the classic Infertility Counseling, a comprehensive handbook for clinicians. One more time, Ms. Covington, please tell us what you're up to and how we can find you.
I am in private practice and director of psychological support services of Shady Grove Fertility. You can reach me either at shadygrovefertility.com website, or you can go to my website, covingtontherapy.com, and find out more information about me so you know how to get in touch with me.
Along today's journey, we've discussed the different stages of infertility, the psychological impacts, and the financial impacts, as well as the cost of treatment. Thank you to my co-host, Nancy. Thanks to Jeff Newman, my engineer, and thank you to my guest, Sharon Covington. You have been absolutely great. I hope you've had as much fun as I've had hanging out with today's ensemble. As always, it's my wish for you to walk away from this conversation with a heaping helping of useful information that'll help you create a relationship that's as loving and accepting as possible. Let us know what you thought of today's show at Facebook.com/RelationshipFLove, on Twitter at Mr. That's M-R Frank Love, or at franklove.com. If you're listening via Blog Talk Radio, make sure you like us there, and if via iTunes, make sure you subscribe so that you can receive each week's show. This is Frank Love.